from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, if pigeons, squirrels, and weeds don't sound majestic to you, spend the next half hour with our guest Nathaniel Johnson and see if he can convince you otherwise. Johnson has written a book about the everyday plants and animals in the Bay Area called Unseen City, The Majesty of Pigeons, The Discreet Charm of Snails, and Other Wonders of the Urban Wilderness. We'll also be joined by a biologist to answer your questions about the critters just outside your door. Join us on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum's second hour. I'm Mina Kim. Nathaniel Johnson is the food editor for Grist and lives in Berkeley. And in his new book, Unseen City, he invites us to be delighted by the common plants and critters in our cities and suburbs that often annoy us or that we overlook entirely, like snails, ants, ginkgo trees. He suggests a walk to BART can become as wondrous as walking through a national park, and that by taking time to learn more, we can feel more rooted to where we live. Douglas Long is one of those folks who has spent a lot of time learning about our urban ecosystems. He's a research associate at the California Academy of Sciences. Thanks for being here, Douglas Long.
Thank you.
And thanks also to you, Nathaniel Johnson, for being here as well.
My pleasure.
I want to start with you because the inspiration for this book began with your one-year-old daughter who was constantly asking you about the world around her. How did that translate into this book?
So every day I was just walking up the hill in Bernal Heights to take her to childcare, and she was pointing to things and saying, "What's that, Papa? What's that?" And I was like exasperated by this because she was like, "Yeah, that's a tree. That's still actually that's the same tree." And it was this sort of terrible trade-off where I could say the same thing over and over again or listen to her scream. And so to make it a little more interesting, I decided, okay, I could only give her the same answer one time. And then I had to change it up. You know,
so that's a challenge you gave yourself.
Exactly. I changed the rules of the game. So I had to say tree. And then I said, well, that's a leaf. That's a flower. That's a stamen, you know. And by doing that, I zeroed in on this one tree and I saw these tiny flowers that I'd never seen before. And it was this kind of magical moment that right there in front of my face is this beautiful thing that had been completely invisible to me. And so I said, well, what else is out there? And how can I focus in so that instead of just teaching my daughter to see that this is a boring, nameless tree, that there is this richness and beauty all around her that she can have access to.
And there's a lot out there, but you selected just a handful of things to focus on in your book. How did you choose that?
Right. Well, I needed kind of a limiting mechanism for one thing, because, you know, there's millions and millions of creatures out there. But also I was just fascinated by this experience of having that happen, the invisible becoming visible. So I decided to focus in on the creatures that are so common that they're all around us. We see them every day and they become invisible because we just get used to them. So the things that are ubiquitous and therefore unseen.
One of those, of course, being pigeons.
Right.
you know, people have referred to pigeons as flying rats or sky rats, I think you said in your book. And you yourself had your own sort of ambivalence toward pigeons. I thought it was hilarious when I was reading about your experience with a pigeon turd. Could you share that story and then how you sort of evolved from there?
Yeah, I started out very grossed out by pigeons. And yeah, the first time I really noticed that they were all around me was that I was in Buenos Aires and I was eating this cookie that's from there that's dulce de leche and this very white flour. And so it's brown and white. And I was walking to the subway and it was kind of getting dark. And I went down into the subway and it was light there. And I looked down on my sweater and there's this little bit of brown and white. And I thought, oh, some piece of the cookie has fallen off onto my sweater. And, you know, that's great because it's delicious. And I scooped it off and I ate it. And it was not a piece of the cookie. and I figured out immediately what it was and spent the next 5 minutes just kind of retching and silently cursing myself and looking like a crazy person there on the platform. And then I was just incredibly grossed out by pigeon. You know, I'd walk through and they'd fly around me and I'd thrash wildly at the air. And, but it also got me to start watching them because I wanted to like avoid them and protect myself from them. And I started seeing all these interesting things about pigeons. You know, I started noticing that a lot of them had strange messed up feet, and I started wondering about that. I noticed the color of their eyes, which is really strange and extraordinary. I'd never seen that before. And so I started doing more and more research and looking closer at them.
Yeah, the feet thing was interesting because I'd sort of assumed that, you know, being in an urban environment, maybe they'd had battles with machines,
right,
or other things. But you found out something different.
Yeah. So there's all of these theories about what's wrong with pigeon feet. And as I was trying to figure this out, I talked to a lot of people that had these ideas that were just wrong. Like you'll hear people say, oh, they have staph infections but you know, that doesn't really make sense because why staph infections just on their feet and nowhere else? Or, oh, they're cats, but why are cats just eating their feet or cars, you know? And it turns out the most plausible hypothesis for this is just that they're getting their feet tangled up in hair and string. And they, unlike sparrows and other city birds that hop, they kind of shuffle. And so they pick these things up and they get tangled around their poor toes, and it cuts off the circulation, and you get these horrible malignancies that you see, and they just can't get them off. And so it's this – if you want some reason to feel sympathy for pigeons, there you go.
Douglas Long, do you want to give us other reasons to feel sympathy for pigeons? And what do you think of Nathaniel Johnson's hypothesis here?
That actually is the prevailing hypothesis, is that it's a lot of the artificial fibers, different types of monofilament and plastic fibers can get tangled around their feet, and eventually they'll constrict the blood flow. They'll become necrotic, fall off. Not very pleasant way to be living in the city, but ultimately it keeps them alive rather than killing them outright.
Right.
But I think pigeons do have a pivotal role primarily as prey for many other species that are drawn into the city. So, for example, we see that peregrine falcons in San Francisco, they love in nature nesting in cliffs. And so these towers and sky rises that we have in the city provide an artificial cliff platform for them. And the pigeons are an ample food. In more suburban areas where I live in Oakland and where I teach out at St. Mary's College of Moraga, we have an increase in the population of Cooper's hawks. And Cooper's hawks are also bird feeders as well. And so in areas where you have pigeons, you oftentimes have very strong and vibrant raptor communities.
Wow. So this gives us a reason, whether you love or hate pigeons, to appreciate their existence. We're talking with Douglas Long. He's a research associate at the California Academy of Sciences. He's also a lecturer in biology at St. Mary's College in Moraga. And we're also talking with author Nathaniel Johnson. He's written the book Unseen City, The Majesty of Pigeons, The Discreet Charm of Snails, and Other Wonders of the Urban Wilderness. You wanted to add something?
Can I just say, I just saw someone shared a photo of a hawk swooping down and catching a pigeon, you know, right out by the panhandle in San Francisco. So, I mean, this is crazy natural experience that you can see right here in the city, you know, if you're paying attention.
You, Nathaniel Johnson, have also said that observing squirrels can be quite an experience. Could you tell us about the day that you spent at Cal watching squirrels with a researcher there?
Right. So I was out with this squirrel researcher and she took me on a little squirrel walk. Mikel Delgado is her name. And we went out to Cal. It's very easy for her to do her field work because squirrels live all over Berkeley. And she went out with her little nuts that she gives to the squirrels. And we were looking around, first of all, and she was saying, I don't see any squirrels right now. You know, it's a little early, and these squirrels are adjusted to the students' time schedule because the students get up late, they like to sleep in, and they're a major food source for the squirrels because they throw their unwanted pizza and stuff like that. And so that, you know, it's interesting how all of these creatures are adapting to us, you know, whether we notice it or not, they're changing around us. And it was just a fascinating walk because one of the things that she showed me, she tossed this nut to the squirrel and it ran off and it buried it. And she said, okay, let's see if we can find that. First of all, I was like, this is just not fair. You know, it's 10 feet away. I can see exactly where that squirrel buried the nut. And we walked right over to it. But then as you zoom in, something strange happens. You know, you see it's underneath this bush, right? But then you look closer and you say, okay, wait, is it this square inch or is it the square inch next to it or is it 5 inches away? And it all just kind of turns into this mishmash. And we started digging and we couldn't find the nut. And so they're very good at hiding these nuts and also very good at remembering. I mean, that it just sort of brought it home that they're remembering not just that they've hidden this nut underneath this particular bush, but they've hidden it in this one square inch. And they're doing that thousands of times over.
I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. We have asked them what types of critters or plants captivate them on their urban or suburban walks. And we'd love to hear from you at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. Post your comments on Facebook or Twitter or on our website, kqed.org/forum. We're talking with Nathaniel Johnson about his new book on the majesty of pigeons and snails and other wonders of the urban wilderness called Unseen City. And we're also talking with Douglas Long with the California Academy of Sciences. Douglas Long, you have looked at sort of the history of squirrels in this area. Tell us what you found.
Well, the history of squirrels in the Bay Area, it might surprise people. There's the assumption that the squirrels have always been here, and part of that is true. For the tree squirrels, as opposed to the ground squirrels, we have three species that live in our region. One is the western gray squirrel, which is the species that's already been here. But it suffered at the hands of humans early on. They were hunted for food. There was actually a market for gray squirrels. They also aren't as well adapted to urban and suburban landscapes. So during the gold rush and after that, the western gray squirrel started to decline. At the same time, we have people from the East Coast moving out, and they brought with them the other two species of squirrels that we have, the eastern gray squirrel and the fox squirrel, which is the big bushy orangey brown one, the ones that are on the Berkeley campus. And so why were these squirrels brought out on trains or stagecoaches with some of the people moving west? It's always been sort of a mystery.
Yeah.
Because they serve no other function other than the nostalgia of where you used to live. And one of the reasons why these species of eastern squirrels have done so incredibly well is because we have brought with them their native trees from the east. We've brought with them different types of fruit trees. We've brought with them birch and willow and different types of oaks from the East Coast. So not only are they doing well at living in an urban environment, they're doing that because we are providing a habitat that almost mirrors what we have on the East Coast in many ways.
And, you know, Nathaniel Johnson, you talked about this sort of dynamism. I mean, you were saying that it's so much about how we adapt to each other and how we adapt our environments that end up creating ideal environments for both species.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, really, unfortunately, it's mostly the critters adapting to us and not so much us adapting to them. We tend to just notice when they get annoying and try and poison them or whatever. But it would be much more interesting if we could think of ways that we could benefit from these creatures. Squirrels are an interesting example because squirrels weren't in cities even on the East Coast for a long time until people had this concerted effort to bring them into city parks. And this was an effort that failed for a long time. And finally, it started to succeed when the park planning changed with Frederick Law Olmsted and this more naturalistic version of a park that looked more like a squirrel habitat started to take hold. And then, of course, once the squirrels were there, they started planting trees as well because some of the nuts that they're putting in the ground, they might not need or they might die before they go back and eat them. And these turn into trees that they're designing the forest for themselves.
Bruce writes, the cherry plum trees that grow outside our second-story window in West Oakland are wonderful for viewing a myriad of wildlife. We get a variety of migrating birds as well as the local flocks. Squirrels frequent them. And then there's that one time I heard, hey, that's not a cat, and looked out to observe a baby possum climbing in the tree. Douglas Long.
Yeah, possums are another wonderful import that came from the South. In the late 1800s and particularly early 1900s, there was a movement of people from the southeastern U.S. to work in the rail yards and the shipyards in the Bay Area. And when people move, they bring their culture and their cuisine with them. So there was developed a cottage industry throughout the South to live trap possums and to ship them by rail out to California, where they were used as food. And in many instances, these possums were able to escape and eventually establish a feral population. And they are so well at adapting in an urban landscape because they're omnivorous. They can eat virtually anything from dog feces to fallen fruit to, you know, in my case of my neighbor's yard, the kibble he puts out for his cat. They're very adaptable in what they eat, but they also reproduce at a phenomenal rate. And that we've seen just in the past 100 years in California, possums have expanded all the way up to British Columbia and as far south as northern Baja California. And this is also because there's no other animal that really has that ecological niche. They've one of the few invasive animals that's been able to find a way that they can live in an ecosystem that doesn't really impact other types of animals.
When you can live on dog poop, you know your nature is beautiful.
coprophagous is the term. Yes.
Well, let's go to – I asked our callers to – I opened our phone lines early and our callers are weighing in. Let's go to GS in San Leandro. Hi, GS.
Thank you, guys. I have three little quick ones. One, seagulls. Around any BART station, you'll see seagulls flocking, also other kinds of birds flocking. And you know, while you're standing on the platform, just set your eyes on those little flocks. They go zooming around. And, you know, of course, you'll see seagulls at the beach. If you throw bread up into the air, they'll catch it in the air. And if you scatter around, they'll compete to get them. Next thing, just two little quick ones. My younger daughter and I used to walk around the neighborhood just to, you know, have some fun in the sunshine and be bonding as daddy and daughter. And I knew the names of a whole bunch of flowers, you know, daisies and chrysanthemums and roses. But I didn't know all of them. And so we started just counting the rest of the flowers. You know, we discovered five or six, and then we kept going. We got all the way to 36, and she was so proud she could count to 36 and notice the differences. And then finally, with both my daughters, we used to go to Ohlone Park and play and look around and stuff and find the little dandelions, the little puffs in the grass. And finally, we discovered fennel plants. Mm-hmm. And I think my younger daughter had been introduced to them by friends at school. You can eat the fennel plants, and they taste like licorice. And my kids used to love to hunt it out and chew it.
Geez, can I just ask you really quickly how sort of making these discoveries and enjoying the flora and fauna around you, how that's affected you or your relationship with where you live?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's just made me a lot more curious about everything. In fact, here's another one. My mom, I was amazed that this came into my mind once we lived up in Berkeley, moved up here when I was 30. But my mom used to know the names. She was kind of a botanist. She knew the names of every tree you could see in every neighborhood we ever lived in. And so with my younger daughters, then I start saying, oh, you know, when I was little, we used to have a walnut tree growing in our yard. We kept looking for walnut trees, but we could find oak trees and pine trees and anyway, all kinds of different trees. You could know them by their leaves.
Wow.
And so my kids got really good at noticing trees. And, you know, then it extends to little plants crawling around. Yes, of course, the ants, difference between black ants and red ants. You know, every morning, in the morning on a dewy day, the poor little snails, you know, they did not evolve to deal with concrete. And so every once in a while in the late morning, you'd see where they tried to get from A to B, and they had to try to cross this huge freeway for people, and they couldn't handle it. And worms would do the same thing. And as the sun would start to bake them, they wouldn't make it. And then you'd see little carcasses,
yeah,
little tiny worms and snails that didn't make it. And that was very sad, but welcome to the circle of life.
Well, GS, thank you for sharing those observations. You know, I don't know if he's an exception, but it feels like it. I mean, did you get any sense, Nathaniel Johnson, writing this into, you know, why we sort of carry these veils around that stop us from seeing such detail?
Well, I mean, it's hard to pay attention to the little things when they don't have a direct impact on your ability to pay the rent and do all the things that you need to do. And I do think there is this kind of universal experience that people have when they have kids, right, where you start to see the world through their eyes and start to re-notice the little things. But also there's a universal experience of being an adult and having your kid be distracted on the side of the road for like 5 minutes and you're like, come on, you know. So, and then you go and you look and maybe what they're looking at is fascinating and you can see it afresh. And that's wonderful. But it's if we were all so distracted and fresh-eyed as a two-year-old that we'd forget to go to work because we were fascinated by the disgusting thing in the gutter, we wouldn't be able to live. So we need to have these veils, but it's also tremendously refreshing to burn through them every once in a while.
And for those of us who don't have kids, what strategies have you found to help people notice more?
Well, I think you just have to, I mean, you have to have intention to set aside a little time to say, let me look closely at something that I've passed a dozen times and see if I can see something new. There's all sorts of people, you know, people at the California Academy of Sciences, like Douglas, who help with this. The Cal Academy has this app called iNaturalist, which you can take pictures of things and people, there's a community of people that will help you identify it. And actually, there's a contest right now. If you download the app, you know, we're trying to beat LA in the number of identifications that we can make. And it's ongoing this 1 week. So everybody should try that. But there's all of these little ways that you can find like support groups or learn more about your non-human neighbors and start to see all of this richness that you may be just walking by without noticing.
Douglas Song.
And one of the best ways to get involved is through urban birdwatching. There's a number of different birdwatching groups throughout the Bay Area and particularly places like Lake Merritt, which is in the center of a well-developed urban area, has an amazing amount of wildlife. And so once you start looking at the birds, you start noticing the plants, you notice the butterflies, you start to say, hey, what kind of lizard is that? So bird watching is a gateway drug into nature in many ways.
Don in Oakland. Hi, Don.
Hi. Let me turn off this. Speaking of bird watching, as I go out on my back porch and go into my garden in North Oakland, I've noticed that I've identified it as a Bewick's wren. A bird starts calling immediately. And I've tried to do my imitation of its call, and not so good, but the bird responds immediately, and this goes back and forth as long as I can stand it. The bird seems to continue it, but I'm wondering what's going on.
Yeah, well, Don, stay on the line through the break, and we'll get an answer for you right after the break. We're talking about the flora and fauna around you with Nathaniel Johnson, author of Unseen City, on the majesty of pigeons and the discreet charm of snails and other wonders of the urban wilderness. And we're also talking with Douglas Long, research associate at the California Academy of Sciences and a lecturer in biology at St. Mary's College in Moraga. We'll talk more about what's happening with Don and his wren right after the break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the wonders of the critters just outside our door. And Don in Oakland, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Great. And you have a critter, a wren, that's been imitating a call or at least responding to you. Douglas Long, do you have some thoughts on that?
I have Bewick's wrens in my yard as well. I live in Oakland. I think I've recorded almost 90 different species of birds. 12 of them breed in my backyard. And Bewick's wrens are the ones that breed. And what we've seen last year, they had three separate clutches, three nests of babies, and usually they do that once a year. And that's one of the benefits of living in an urban environment because there's plenty of nesting sites, and oftentimes food is more abundant than not. And what's probably happening if you're going out and these birds are calling at you, it's usually a call that you are an intruder. And I see the same thing. When I go outside, they start this sort of high-pitched zit, zit, zit sound. Or a trill, and I watch them. If a dog goes by the sidewalk, do the same sound when they see a dog or a feral cat. But they won't respond if they see other sparrows or even squirrels. So it's probably that they see you as being in their territory and they're giving a warning call to their mate possibly.
I see. Okay. Great. Thanks.
Well, Don, thanks for the call. And if you'd like to join the conversation, that's 733-866-733-6786. Again, the number 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. And Ben writes, daily I walk home and watch a group of crows and one hawk dogfight each other in the air. It is the most majestic and amazing thing that I get to witness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this, I wrote a lot about crows, and that this was kind of my entry point as well. And seeing this, like, what's going on with these? Are these two hawks? Are these? But there's multiple. Oh, they're crows, and the crows are going after the hawks and really harassing them. And this is dangerous for the crows. You know, every once in a while, a crow will get too close, and they're gone. And so there's all of these interesting theories about why. They do this, you know, because they do it. It's not just that they're chasing the hawks away from their nests, because they're doing it out of nesting season as well. And so I spent some time talking with some crow researchers, John Marsliff up in Seattle, and other people. And basically what he was saying is that perhaps it's almost a cultural thing where there's this, you know, demonstration of prowess, or perhaps it's like a game, like, you know, big wave surfing where you're teasing this higher power and seeing how close you can get.
Well, we have a crow question here. John writes, putting crow facial recognition to the test. On my daily commute to work, I've been tossing out kibble to all the crows along my path. 2 years in, they have gotten into the habit of landing on trees ahead of me and waiting for a feeding. Every once in a while, I will miss one and they will do a fly by my head to get my attention. This morning was a first. As I was riding, one bonked me on the head as if to say,
wow.
Hey, here I am. Is that what they're saying, Douglas Long?
Crows and ravens and even scrub jays are all in the same family, the corvids. They're very intelligent animals and they're very quick learners. And they do recognize those individuals that feed them. There's been many documented cases and plenty of lore throughout the centuries of crows recognizing people and even sort of following them, working with them, even in some cases giving them offerings as well. So I'm not surprised that once the crows become habituated to food, they recognize the person that's feeding them and the schedule that person has, that they work into their own little birdie calendar.
Well, how do you tell crows and ravens apart?
Ravens are much larger, longer wingspan. You'll see the tips of the wings look sort of more like little fingers at the ends. They have a thicker bill, a much coarser voice. Crows tend to be in larger groups. Ravens are either solitary or in pairs. But ravens have been shown to be even much more intelligent than crows in laboratory situations where they're able to work out very complex problem-solving experiments.
Wow. Yeah. Well, Shana writes, I love observing dandelions on my walk. Hmm. They're so resilient, growing out of cracks in the concrete and lawns despite poisonous weed killers. They're an underappreciated flower. They are also incredibly nutrient-dense and are entirely edible. So I gather the leaves and flowers for salads. And Nathaniel Johnson, you have also come to appreciate weeds for their strength and resilience. But at the same time, you were cautious about which ones you put in your mouth.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you can go wrong here, but it is an amazing way to interact with nature, right? I mean, normally we interact with nature through our eyes, but as soon as you stick one in your mouth, you're smelling it, you're tasting it, you have that mouth feel, and it does something to your brain. Once your brain registers, there's food out there. You know, this sort of undifferentiated mess of weeds. It's very easy to start remembering the names of these plants if you are looking for the ones that you can eat. And it's amazing that a lot of these ones that are so invasive and so hardy, like dandelions, like mallow, are weeds that you can eat.
And that's actually one of the tips that you suggest for folks who are interested in engaging with their local flora and fauna, is that as you're going around, taste your surrounding or chew something, you know, from your local environment as you are going about it. So how do you make sure that you're not getting one that's, you know, been peed on or that, you know, that's absorbed a bunch of car exhaust? Or are there ways that you discern between which weeds and which areas to pick?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely pick ones that are higher up or off the beaten path a little bit. But I mean, it's also, I think that in general, the risks are fairly low. If you have a good idea of what that plant is, and you're pretty sure that you're not picking one that has a there are a few that have that are look very much like others that are poisonous. So I'm very careful about those. But I mean, in terms of a little bit of exhaust, I mean, I think that the dangers of those types of things are pretty minimal compared to the dangers we take, you know, driving to work every day and that sort of thing.
And the nutrition,
Douglas Long,
that these weeds provide are also going to be food for other urban animals. So, for example, one of the reasons why deer have become so abundant in that wild-urban interface is because we are growing those types of plants that are edible and delicious and easily accessible. So the deer population is increasing or has increased in many urban areas. That has then brought in, like in Southern California, coyotes coming into urban areas, or in the Bay Area we're getting sightings of mountain lions into urban areas. They're going after the deer. So by the plants that we put in our garden, we're actually creating unwittingly an ecological cascade that happens.
Well, Jeff writes, certain animals do seem to thrive in urban environments. Doesn't it boil down to the fact that these species continue to reproduce, whereas the ones we don't see any longer, for whatever reason, are more affected by human presence and simply quit reproducing? Thoughts on that, Douglas?
That's absolutely true. There are many species that just don't adapt well to encroachment, and that encroachment might eliminate their breeding sites, might eliminate their food resources. Other animals, like raccoons, are omnivorous. They can live in just about any type of habitat as long as there's food or water, which we provide for them. And so in an urban area, the population of raccoons can be, in some cases, 10 times higher than in the wild, because we give them food, we give them shelter, there's very few predators left. And so it's a perfect union between our unwitting ability to provide for them and the raccoon's incredibly adept way at being able to adapt to us.
Well, let's go to Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I tend to work and be involved more with native flora and fauna. But a couple of years ago, there was pigeons, a male and a female, right outside my back door. They had found a place to nest. And I watched them for many times over a period of a year and a half, 2 years. And I was so impressed with the way that they worked so hard to take care of each clutch of young that they had, and how they watched out for each other if one or the other was, you know, not doing well for a few days. And the female ended up getting her foot entwined and lost her foot. And I became so impressed with watching the pigeons, and also sort of realized that they are really beautiful birds, and if there were only a few of them, we would all be out looking for them, and we would love them. But because there are so many, and because they're so successful at adapting to our life, just like rats, raccoons, we tend to think of them as bad animals and filthy animals. And the only reason that they're dirty is because they're living in our dirt. We're the dirty ones, so... I just want to say thank you so much for writing the book. I look forward to reading it, because I think people do need to pay attention to the wildlife around them and think a little further about, you know, these things.
Well, Judy, thanks for sharing your story.
Thanks for having open eyes. That's really cool. It's pretty rare to see pigeons raising their young, because they're usually they're cave dwellers. You know, they usually hide away, but they're great parents. They do tend to have long-term mates. They take care of each other, and the reason you don't see their young, aside from the fact that they're hidden away in these crevices, is that they also they produce milk from their crops that they feed to their, both the males and the females, they feed to their babies. And so they're incredibly good at nurturing their young and bringing them up.
Well, let's go to Marga in Oakland. Hi, Marga.
Hi. I want to thank Forum. This is my favorite subject, and I didn't know about these two terrific guests in this new book, so I am very excited. Now, the other thing I want for the guests is to try to condense 80 years of my life into saying why this is such an important subject to me and how happy I am and how much I want to spread the word about this. When I was 3, I was paralyzed from the neck down with polio, not uncommon in the 30s. And so I got to watch nature. Just that's about all I could do is sit outside while I was waiting for muscles to regrow and watch the ants, the birds, everything. And that has served me so well all my life because I became a science writer and editor and things. And I want children today to have this same experience. I went back when I was in my 60s and retrained to be a Head Start school teacher. And the children there, they are so hungry for what these guests are talking about, knowing and sharing with adults. And so I want to know how we can get these writers to share, to, you know, to be so popular that all the Head Start can do.
Yeah. That's a great question. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'd be interested in talking more with you.
It doesn't take a ton of equipment to start to really engage with the world, does it?
No, and it's right there outside your door. I mean, you don't really need anything. I have a little hand lens that I love to use, you know, just a little magnifying glass. That opens up this whole new miniature world that you can look at.
It's small enough, I think you wrote, to put on your keychain so that you can just rip it out whenever you see something that interests you.
Yeah, exactly.
You also recommend just carrying a journal.
Yeah. I like to note when something flowers or when a bird comes back, and you know, you can start to see, okay, this happened on this day in the springtime, and does that change the next year? And it just helps you pay attention to these things and notice that.
And if you don't know what an animal is, there are Douglas apps Long. Like iNaturalist, which allows you to take a picture with your phone. And if you don't know what it is, you could post it and you'll have other members of the community be able to identify it for you. And just I wanted to expand on something that the caller mentioned. And that is, there is an emerging branch of psychology looking at how kids interact with nature and how that ultimately develops their psychology. And it's been shown that where kids are able to interact with nature, they have a greater sense of independence, greater ability for problem solving, increased attention span. And there's a great book by Richard Louv called Last Child in the Woods, which looks at how children interact with nature, ultimately become much better citizens and much sort of better psychologically adapted adults because of that experience.
That's a great point. Well, let's go to Sky in San Francisco. Hi, Sky.
Hi. I live in the Haight, and I have been smelling lilac bushes for the last 3 or 4 years that I've lived there, and it's really reminiscent of home for me back in Montana, where I would smell them every summer. My parents had a big lilac bush that grew there. And it wasn't until I actually started walking around the Haight about maybe 2-3 weeks ago, just wandering around, not really, you know, noticing where I was going, that I found where the lilac bush was, like three blocks away from my house. And it was just that great, just kind of going out and just exploring and discovering something really special like that.
Well, thanks, Guy, for sharing that story.
It's nice to have these projects, right? And then every time you smell that lilac bush, you'll know where it's coming from. You know, all as we walk through the city, the natural world is sending us all of these messages. And if you exert just a little effort, you can learn what those messages mean. And each one is attached to this ecological story. And these are fascinating stories if you have just a little bit of information and know how to read those stories.
And what I like, too, about what you said in your book, Nathaniel Johnson, is that it makes nature really accessible, and also the tip of maybe choosing one thing a month so that it's not too overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll often – like I am – you know, embarrassingly bad at identifying things. You know, I feel like I should know the name of everything. But I'll just try and be like, okay, this tree, I'm going to figure out what this tree is this month. And iNaturalist helps a lot. But sometimes, you know, I'll have to do it on my own and really dig in. But that's a perfectly acceptable challenge for me.
Well, a listener writes, I once gave a tour to a group of visiting conservationists from all over the world. I kept having to wait for the Brazilians, who work in one of the most biodiverse places on the planet. I went back to walk with them and figured out why. They were amazed by the squirrels. Yeah. They were taking hundreds of photos of squirrels. It was a reminder that everywhere you live on this planet holds wonder, even in something as seemingly mundane to us as squirrels.
Yeah.
That's a great story. Ted emails, on 80 at 580 near Albany, I frequently see pigeons who seem to fly alongside the cars. I wonder if anyone else has seen them and what is going on. Douglas
yes,
Law?
I see the same thing. And then they're actually nesting in these crevices underneath the flyover, the freeway flyover. So their behavior of nesting in caves or in crevices has been replicated by these crevices that are on that freeway flyover.
That's cool to know.
Yeah. Wow. Well, let's go to more calls. Neil in San Francisco. Hi, Neil.
Hello. I was wondering, is the rat population in this city any worse than it is anywhere else as far as you can tell? And what's your opinion of the feral cats?
Okay, thanks, Neil. Douglas Long, you want to take that?
Two very big boxes of worms, so to speak. the rat, we have two species of rats in the Bay Area that are associated with humans. We have the black rat and the Norwegian rat. And neither one, at least as far as I've been able to see and conversations I've had with vector control people, they don't seem to be in the levels that you hear about in New York and Chicago. I haven't seen rats dragging pizza downstairs or, you know, stories of rats carrying children out of their cribs or anything like that. But there are – both species are here, but they tend not to be as abundant. And the whole feral cat issue is another hour-long segment because – I mean, personally, I have cats. I love cats, but they're all rescue cats. They're all fixed, and they're all indoors permanently. Cats do great damage to bird, small mammal, reptile populations, and when their populations get too big, numerous studies have shown that the biodiversity in the region plummets when you have feral cats.
Wow. It's quite a fact. Well, Bruce writes, while driving near Rohnert Park in February, I was surprised to see a bald eagle land in an oak tree. I stopped to observe this large bird and was soon joined by a small throng of people who had also pulled over. Apparently, there are quite a few living out near Jenner by the sea. There is a Facebook page chronicling them, Bald Eagles of the Sonoma Coast.
Huh, cool. I didn't know that.
Bald eagles eat fish primarily, and so where they're feeding is at the mouth of the Russian River and along parts of the coast. So when there's a salmon run or the lamprey are coming up to spawn, they're primarily eating those fish. They're also scavengers too, so dead fish. And I've even seen them scavenge off seal and dolphin carcasses along the coast.
Wow. Well, again, we're talking with Douglas Long, a research associate at the California Academy of Sciences, and Nathaniel Johnson, a food editor for Grist and the author of Unseen City, The Majesty of Pigeons, The Discreet Charm of Snails, and Other Wonders of the Urban Wilderness. Noel writes, Canada geese are everywhere. They no longer feel the need to migrate.
That's a phenomenon that's been seen throughout the U.S., believe it or not. When you have a golf course, it supplies a pond, plenty of grass. Lake Merritt, their population of Canadian geese have been increasing. And from my own observations, it looks like a lot of them have decided to stay there. Rather than it being a waypoint during their migration, that we now have these urban populations that are year-round and they're being supported by grass and crumbs that people are throwing out. And so they've been adapting to that urban landscape in a tremendous way.
Wow.
One of the things that you start to see when you're looking at nature closely and you have the opportunity to do that in cities is that it changes, right? That it's always in flux. We often tend to think like, you know, geese migrate. This is a fact of nature, right? But in fact, geese adapt and evolve, and it's always changing. And it's, you know, you could see it as a bad thing, or you could just, you know, watch with curiosity.
And let's go to Barbara in Mill Valley. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Oh, great program.
Thanks.
I have a story, not a question, about a population of squirrels. Some foreign government gave the White House in the early 1950s some black squirrels, which were not native to the region. And President Eisenhower got really mad because these squirrels were moving his golf balls on the White House putting green. And so he ordered that the squirrels be relocated. And somebody, the Secret Service or somebody, gathered up, caught all these squirrels, trapped them, and took them out to Montgomery County, Maryland, where I lived, 20 miles as the crow flies, we used to say, from the White House. And so now, and this goes back to the 1950s, Montgomery County has a population of black squirrels that were never there before.
Mm. Yeah, I haven't heard that story before. I know that there are black squirrels in that region that are just a genetic variant of the eastern grays, but there may be something else that I haven't heard about as well.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Barbara. Let's go to John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you? Thanks
I'm
for
well.
Taking the call. I have to say that your guest has just called to mind one of the memories I really treasure about growing up with my daughter. And she, at 2.5 years old, she had a real affinity for these Carl's Jr.'s chicken stars. And one Saturday afternoon, she wanted to go get them. And, adults, even if we're a real spontaneous breed, we're still far more pragmatic than a 2.5-year-old. And we're marching to the beat of a much more rapid tempo, I guess. So I pull up the car, we're going to go get lunch, and I get out and I start making my way to the door, and I feel her little hand tugging at my pants. She goes, wait. And she pulls me down to the grass there. There was a little patch of grass in front of the place, and she parked the grass, and there's a little parade of ants walking by, and every few of them had a little piece of bread that they were watching. And she just was so fascinated with that. We sat there for an hour and a half, and it took a child. I'll never forget it because she pulled me into the moment. Yeah. I think you spend hundreds of dollars on self-help books, how to relax and stay in the moment. And she did it with one swoop of the brush there. And I remember reading about 6 months later an article that Maria Montessori had written saying that up until the age of 3, we all are much more attached to the moment and to nature than we lose it, which is... That must be God's little joke. He takes it away from us. But I just, I want to thank you for reminding me of that. I'll never forget that. And through the years, I spent a lot of time watching what was going on around us because of her. Thank you.
John, thanks for the story.
Well, those kids Douglas that Long. Don't lose that ability to observe are the ones that become biologists. I do the same thing. I, stop on the sidewalk and look at a strange grasshopper I haven't seen before or watch that Cooper Hawk in the backyard tear apart a pigeon. And it's fascinating. I mean, always been interested in nature, and to be able to further cultivate that in kids, I think is fantastic.
Yeah. Speaking of kids, one of the things that I noticed, Nathaniel Johnson, in reading your book is that you start to describe your daughter almost like the species that you are examining. You detail the way her expression when she's chewing a weed or contemplating a new flavor. And it was sort of interesting. It just struck me that she became one of your subjects in a way.
Yeah, that's really well put. And I hadn't thought of it that way. But I think there's this sort of twofer when you have a kid. First of all, they pull you into the moment, like that last caller so eloquently just described. But also, you want to be in the moment with them, right? You want to observe them and suck up every moment of their cuteness and their growth. And so there's this tremendous opportunity there to be present with them.
Well, Shelley asks, do worms give live birth? In my garden soil, I found large groups of young worms with a very few large worms, but I've never seen eggs, so I assume they give live birth. Is this correct?
It depends what type of worms. The earthworms that we have, I don't think give live birth. They produce these little sort of mucousy egg capsules that eventually hatch underground. But it could be where there's a high number of small worms, it could mean that the soil is very rich and it's a high reproductive output of the few large worms that are there. So.
Well, thanks for the question, Shelley. And let's go to Joan in San Jose. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Yes, our inner city kids really don't have the opportunity to get to the magnificent county parks and the open space preserves that ring the Bay Area because there's no transportation. If their parents are working and can't drive, and if they're too young to drive and they take their hands in their life riding the freeway and the bicycle, there's VTA, Valley Transportation Authority, SamTrans, they don't go out to Portola Valley down to Alma Den, where the parks are. They stop where the city ends, and there's, I guess, not enough business for them. But the kids need to get down after school on weekends to get out to really get into nature.
Well, Joe, and I'm sure you wouldn't get disagreement with this group, Nathaniel Johnson.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every child deserves to have that opportunity to get out and see something really beautiful. But and also, we can go to them and we can show them what's right outside their door that they might be missing. They're probably already looking at it. They just need some instruction.
Yeah, there's a number of wildlife rehabilitation centers in the Bay Area, specifically Wild Care and the Lindsay Nature Experience. I think they've changed the name now. And they do outreach to schools where they will actually bring live animals. They have education programs. They have materials that they can give to teachers so that those teachers could develop their own nature curricula. But I do agree, it's tragic that we have so many parks embedded within the urban matrix of the Bay Area and so close to the periphery of the Bay Area that just to get kids like maybe 5 or 10 miles, I mean, just going from the flats of downtown Oakland to the Oakland Hills is just a tremendous change where you can introduce these kids to the basic experiences that nature can provide. But it's just a matter of transportation, which is ultimately a matter of money.
Well, one thing that is nice about your book, Nathaniel Johnson, is that it is about seeing what's immediately out your door. And yeah. I think one goal for me from reading your book is to actually hear a snail chew. I never knew I could.
Right.
What does it sound like?
So it's just this you have to get very close. You have to put your ear right up to them and catch them while they're eating. But it sounds like a very tiny person chewing a very, very tiny, like doll-sized piece of celery. It's just this crunch, crunch, crunch. They've got these thousands of tiny little teeth, and they just chew away. You can see, if you look through a magnifying glass, you can see their little mouths working away, and it's cool.
Well, I hope our listeners have been inspired, and it's been so inspiring to hear them watching worms and squirrels do more of that this weekend. Thank you, Nathaniel Johnson.
Thank you.
Author of Unseen City, The Majesty of Pigeons, The Discreet Charm of Snails, and Other Wonders of the Urban Wilderness. And thank you to you, Douglas Long.
Thank you.
He's with the California Academy of Sciences. Thanks to our listeners for sharing their stories. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Mel Baker. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with help from Amanda Font. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Joanne Wallace is our executive producer. And our interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadeb. I'm Mina Kim. Thank you for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.